Morning, Council.
May it please the court, my name is Joseph Rhodes, and along with Kester Cross, I represent the Butler family, who are the appellants in this matter. We're here today because of an unfortunate incident which occurred on January 20th, 2001, which ultimately resulted in the untimely death of Jeremiah Butler, who was 8 years old on January 20th, 2001. As the members of the court are aware, Jeremiah and his older sister and cousins were playing at a community center in Newark, Delaware, which was adjacent to the Newark Country Club. During their play, they either climbed over or through a split rail fence that separated the two properties. They walked around and onto a pond, an irrigation pond that was used by the Newark Country Club to irrigate various aspects of the golf course. Unfortunately, the ice was not even, and Jeremiah ultimately fell into the pond. He was in the water for about 45 minutes, and after he was extricated, he was seriously injured and passed away a year later. The Superior Court granted the Country Club's motion for summary judgment based on the following rulings. One, there was nothing artificial about the pond which lured Jeremiah to it. And two, Section 339C of the Restatement Second of Torts, which deals with the issue of whether children, because of their youth, are able or not able to realize a danger. Section 339C had not been satisfied because the risk associated with bodies of water is obvious, and children who are old enough to be outdoors without supervision are old enough to understand that risk.
While it might not have been articulated, is there any significance to what the record might suggest, and that is that the mother warned the child to stay away from the pond or be careful around the pond?
That's certainly a fact, Your Honor, that needs to be taken into consideration. That's one of several facts, and I agree that that is obviously an important issue in the case. The question obviously is not did she warn, but what was the ultimate effect of the warning on the 8-year-old child? Because, and I agree
well,
that was
an objective or a subjective.
Well, I think
analysis.
I think what has to happen, Your Honor, is that it's part of a series of facts that have to be looked at, and that is one. There are a lot of other facts that occurred after that that we believe would suggest that, notwithstanding that warning, Jeremiah did not really appreciate the obviousness of the problem, or he did not appreciate the fact that it was a dangerous condition. I can give you a couple of suggestions, Your Honor. For instance, when the children went to the pond, he was with two older relatives. He obviously was relying upon them in order to determine whether or not he would do what they did. One of the relatives tested the pond. The living relatives testified that they assumed that once they were on the pond in one area which was solid, that it was safe throughout. As the court is aware,
what does the mere fact that they were testing it before they went in suggest to the 8-year-old?
Well, it suggests to the 8-year-old that he can put his confidence in his older relatives, that they know what they're doing, and that, in a sense, may somewhat negate a warning that had been given to the child at an earlier time. And I do want to remind the court that in between those two events, the children were playing in and around the community center. The children had available to them swing sets and different elements there. And there is a period of time between the warning and the children going on the pond. And to an 8-year-old, that could mean the difference between remembering what mom said and not remembering what mom said. And so while I agree, Your Honor, that that is definitely a matter for consideration by a jury, it's not the only matter for consideration by a jury. And for that reason, even though it is part of a general scheme, I believe that it is something that needs to be looked at overall.
Well, is it fair to say that you believe that it's a subjective analysis that's put to that individual rather than someone looking at it as an objective person would?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that I think the answer to your question is yes, and I'll explain. I believe that we all of these cases involve looking at facts after the facts. And for that reason, there is an element of subjectivity in our review. And just as when you say he was warned, and the only way that you can tell whether he understood the warning or not is what someone subjectively observed about his reaction.
You're basically advocating a strict liability standard on the duty of the owner of the pond, then, aren't you?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that this is the same type of test that has actually been applied in other situations where you have to look at the facts, apply the facts to the restatement, see whether the elements of the restatement have in fact been met. And if the elements of the restatement have been met, then the plaintiff in that case would survive a summary judgment motion, as we were unfortunately not able to do in this particular case.
Can you comment on comment J, illustration 6 under section 339? I'll read it to you just to make that easier. A has on his land a small artificial pond in which, to A's knowledge, children of the neighborhood frequently trespass and swim. A takes no precautions of any kind. B, a boy 10 years old who cannot swim, trespasses on A's land, enters the pond, and is drowned. A is not liable to B.
Well, Your Honor, I the only comment that I could make is that there are certain facts in this case that would make this a little bit different. And I understand that he is aware that children are, A is aware that children are on the property. But in this particular case, we have a pond, and I'll commend to the court the sections of the appendix where the photographs are, a pond that is directly adjacent to the community center. You can actually visualize the pond from the community center. It is a situation where the children, as they're playing, can see something that is attractive to them or different or they want to get involved in. I would submit that since under those circumstances, every one of these cases is somewhat fact-based, that the facts in this particular case would make it somewhat different than the illustration that you just read to me.
Your argument in this case turn on the fact that the pond was an artificial pond?
Well, I have to prove, Your Honor, that there was an artificial condition on the land in order for the restatement to be applicable.
Can you agree? Well, the Superior Court made alternate holdings. First, that it wasn't an artificial condition, and second, if it was, C was not satisfied as a matter of law.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I think there's a clarification on the first ruling that you suggested. I believe that the Superior Court actually indicated that there was an artificial quality to this pond, but that it was not the artificial qualities that lured Jeremiah Butler to the pond. And that gets back to what I consider, and I hope the court ultimately agrees, a vestige of the classic attractive nuisance doctrine as opposed to the current law which we employ, which is Restatement Second, Section 339. The idea of allurement or luring a child on was something that was an important factor in classic attractive nuisance doctrine. But if you look at the restatement as it's worded, instead of the condition being what is required to lure the child on the property, it says in subsection A, quote, the place where the condition exists is one upon which the possessor knows or has reason to know that children are likely to trespass. So, in other words, I believe reading section 339, the concept of allurement does not have the significance that it had under the more classic doctrine. In fact, our position is that if all of the elements of Section 339 are met, then the court need look no further in terms of other issues.
Why wouldn't, if alluring or not alluring is an issue, why wouldn't the court look at whether the child's mother warned them, don't be allured, don't go to the pond, or whatever wording she may have used,
Your Honor,
why doesn't that change how alluring the pond might be?
Your Honor, I
recognizing that it's a boy, and some of us were once, and I understand that factor.
And that's an important factor in this case, Your Honor, because, you know, we're trying as adults to understand what went on in the mind of a child. And as I said, I do believe that the fact that he was warned is a significant issue in the case. And I do believe that it, if we were in front of the jury, I would hear that several times. But I do believe that that was one factor among all the other factors that occurred when you're making that that determination.
How do you reconcile that argument with the illustration that Justice Ridgely read? Because it seems to suggest that in the restatement, where they're trying to gather the law from around the country and state it in a clear way, the illustration would suggest that the 10-year-old trespasser would not be able to recover under the restatement. And now you added one fact, which was the community center being close by. And what are the other things that distinguish this case from the example in the footnote of the restatement?
Well, I think the most significant fact is the one that I've already mentioned, Your Honor, because as I said, if I'll commend this to your review after the oral argument is over with, but if you look at the appendix on pages 295, 300, and 303, you will see, and various other photographs show, that we are looking at a pond that is so contiguous that it's inescapable to children who are playing. And I believe that's an important fact.
Well, that's why I want you to clarify the distinction, because the illustration in the restatement seems to say A is aware people, children trespass there. And you seem to be saying, in our case, the owner is really aware or somehow qualify the awareness, but the illustration in the restatement assumes awareness that children are trespassing.
Your Honor, I can't escape what the comment says. I can only tell you that under these circumstances, when the restatement illustrations are made, they're made with the best intentions. They're made with the hope that they clarify issues as opposed to make the issues murkier. I can only say that it's our position in this particular case that the facts and circumstances of this case make this a clearer indication because of the proximity, make it a clearer indication because of prior knowledge on the part of the owner. The employees of the owner chased children off of the property. They saw them run back to the community center. They know that's implicitly where they came from. So under those circumstances, we would submit that this would be one of those situations that would be different from the illustration and one that we would still be able to make a recovery.
Mr. Rhodes, what, with respect to your underlying claim, what is it that you were contending that the country club didn't do that it should have done?
Well, there's a couple of ways to go about this, Justice Jacobs. I'll give you an example. Before some modifications to the area were made,
there was a fence. There was a no trespassing sign. What more should they have done to avoid liability?
Well, the fence in this particular case on the day in question was a split rail fence. It was not a fence, in our opinion, it was not a fence that was designed to keep people out. In fact, the superintendent of the grounds, whose name is Kevin Mayu, has testified that he did not see fences as a method of keeping people out. He felt that signs were the way that people were kept out.
Well, that's like saying the door to your house is not a mechanism to keep people out, locked or unlocked. People should be free to just open the door and walk in.
Your Honor, I respectfully submit that what I really meant by that was that if you have a split rail fence between a community center and a golf course where there is a pond within a short distance, you're talking about children. The question
is... Yeah, but a fence means this property inside the fence is mine, not yours. Keep out. Now, the only issue beyond that is the extent to which you go to keep every conceivable intruder from coming in through the fence. So it's not a 12-foot chain-link fence with barbed wire at the top. It's a split rail fence. But it still says to anyone outside the property, if you cross this fence, you're on my property. And it does have at least a subliminal message, keep out, doesn't it?
To an adult, I would say yes. The question in this case is whether or not, under the circumstances of this case, with children playing in a community center, their mindset at the time is a playful mindset. They look over, they see a split rail fence. How many of us in our days have
well, you keep forgetting in your statement of the facts that it's difficult for their mindset to be playful in the pond because the mothers just told them, don't go there. It's dangerous.
I understand, Your Honor.
You keep leaving that fact out.
Well, I'm not leaving it out, Your Honor. I think I've indicated that I understand that that's an important fact in the case. The question is, in the continuum of events, because in essence, the warning is the beginning of the event.
Well, in answering my question, you're saying the fence wasn't designed the right way. Perhaps it should have been a chain link fence with barbed wire. Perhaps it should have been a concrete wall 6 feet thick, whatever. But that was one example of failure to exercise due care?
That's correct.
Was there any other?
Well, the others would be, let me just underscore what I just said about that. There was a chain link fence there before 1999. It was peeled back by the country club, and in its place, the split rail fence was put, and there was a gate that was put there that would allow the country club to have access to the area with heavy equipment. So, and that prior chain link fence did actually have barbed wire on it. So that would probably be the best method of assuring that the children would stay out of the area to have a more effective fence.
Short of electrifying it.
Well, but Your Honor, it's not uncommon for fences.
Yeah, well, you were going to explain the other claim of negligence.
Well, there are a lot of ways to secure the property. For instance, my colleague showed photographs where down in Sussex County, a particular retention basin has actually been fenced. It's actually been fenced around the pond itself. That would be another method. This is a working pond. This is a pond that is used. It's a storage facility. Instead of having an above ground water tank, they chose to in 1999 enlarge the pond. It was a 500,000 gallon pond. They took the water out. They enlarged it to a million gallons. And at that point in time, it's our position that they should have made a decision that this was a pond that had a lot of qualities to it that would attract the kids to the area because the kids are right
before
there.
Before you get off on that, your second claim is that the fence should have been built around the pond?
As an alternative.
Well, isn't there something in the record to suggest the pond also functions as a water hazard for the 18th hole?
There is a suggestion that it does, Your Honor. The question was it necessary? It's off to the left. It's in the maintenance area of the golf course. And one of the president of the club at the time had indicated to me in a deposition that he couldn't tell whether there were no skating signs down there because he didn't go there very often. And so that suggests – I'm sorry, Your Honor. That suggests that this is not a pond that was one of the vital – areas of the golf course in terms of water hazards.
There hasn't been any discussion so far about what I understand to be, you know, the water flow through the pond that made it other than a normal, a natural pond would just freeze up and that would be that, but this one had a pipe underground or something like that and it kept water moving, and that's part of why one part of the pond was frozen solid and another part of the pond was not. Where does that, assuming my facts are basically correct, where does that stand in terms of your claim? What is the significance of that?
Justice Berger, your understanding of the facts are correct. There was a creek and it was diverted into this pond area.
Okay, what does that do for your case? What's its significance?
I'm sorry to interrupt. The significance is that the children's impression of the pond in the area that they got on the pond, which was removed from the area where the intake pipe comes in, was that it was a solid ice. There was solid ice on the pond. Unfortunately, in the area of the intake valve, the intake pipe, there was running water and the water actually...
Right, okay. I understand the facts. What I'm asking you is what do those facts do in terms of your legal argument? You know, where does that place you in the spectrum in terms of the restatement or any other basis for your claim?
Well, it supports our argument that subsection C of section 339 has in fact been met, because the children did not appreciate the fact that the water was running and causing agitation in that area, and as they walked across the pond, there was a difference in thickness of the ice.
So what you're saying is that the trial court erred in finding that subsection C was not satisfied as a matter of law because there was a special circumstance relating to the way this pond was fed.
I'm saying, I think, Your Honor, that subsection C was not met, that the court's ruling that subsection C was not met as a matter of law was in error because the facts suggest otherwise.
Thank you.
And
the facts do suggest, don't they, that the children understood that there may be portions of the pond that were frozen solid, there may be portions that were not, regardless of a lack of knowledge about an underground pipe. And that's the reason that they tested it before they walked out on it. Isn't it common knowledge that depth of a pond, the closeness of the pond to the shore, all affects the extent to which the pond's water will freeze?
To an adult, I would say yes, that's correct, Your Honor. To an 8-year-old, I don't know that.
Why did they test it then, if they didn't have that same understanding?
I don't believe that there was any question as to whether or not, a specific question as to why they tested it. All I can say is that one of the children put his foot on it. The young boy observed that, and after that he got on, and at that point in time they were all playing on the pond.
Well, my recollection of the facts must be wrong then. I didn't think it was simply that a child put his foot on it. I thought everyone there knew that a child was testing it to see whether or not it was solid enough to walk on it before any of them went out there. Is that true or not?
I think that's an implication from the facts, Your Honor, yes.
It's not conceded, as a matter of fact.
I don't believe that anyone's that I can say what the 8-year-old boy was doing at that point in time other than observing that as his sister indicated.
Well, I guess that's an answer. You want to save the rest of your time?
Please. Thank you.
May I please support? I would like to present the case a little less factually and more conceptually and possibly even more briefly, but I would like to read from this court's decision last month in the Handler case talking about duty. This court said, quote, "We recognize that whether a duty exists is entirely a question of law to be determined by reference to the body of statutes, rules, principles, and precedents which make up the law, and it must be determined by the court," as the trial court did in this case. Now, Justice Jacobs asked what it is that the plaintiffs were contending the country club had to do, and just so it's clear, what the plaintiff's contention in this case is that the country club had a legal obligation to render this pond and presumably any other pond inaccessible. That's exactly what the contention is. And that duty is not found in any Delaware law, statute, precedent, etc., as I've just read from your decision.
Isn't the argument that your opponent's making is that this pond has some unique features to it by the way the water flowed into it, and therefore children particularly would not perceive that one end would be thin ice and the other end would be thick ice as a result of that?
Well, there's a number of attempts to characterize this pond as somehow being different, because the law is pretty clear that bodies of water don't fall within 339, and I'm going to discuss that, but what I would like to preface it with is what the Delaware law is. And the Delaware law is, and has been for over 50 years, that bodies of water, natural or artificial, are not subject to attractive nuisance or Section 339, absent the existence of some artificial danger or hidden trap. And
why isn't the fact that there's water flowing at one end a hidden trap or a hidden danger, in the sense that you couldn't tell from the surface that there was anything other than a pond, and yet the impact of that underground pipe was that one side of the pond freezes hard and the other side of the pond has only a thin layer of ice?
Well, the difference is that this pond, as probably half the ponds in this country, is an impoundment of a creek. Any pond that's created in that way has water flowing through it. Comes in one side, goes out the other, as was the case here. Anytime there's moving water, the ice that can form in cold weather can be of varying depths. There's nothing in this record to even imply that there was anything unusual about the flow of water in this case. The fact that it came out of pipe at one end doesn't change that at all. If you didn't have pipe and you just had it flowing over the dam that preceded the pipe, the same condition would exist, and it's a natural condition.
Well, let me then make sure I understand you, because I obviously don't know that much about ponds, I guess. Aren't a lot of ponds just a collection of water with no stream feeding them, and you know they get higher when there's a lot of rain and they get lower when there's not a lot of rain?
I think some ponds are that way. I think some ponds are spring-fed and don't have inflow and outflow. What effect the spring feeding would have on how ice forms or doesn't form, I don't know. But certainly many ponds are formed by impoundment of running water. And that's a natural body of water under Delaware law.
Well, certainly I would agree that a pond that is entirely natural, no matter how it's fed, is a natural pond by definition. But the facts here, if I'm not mistaken, are that there's a pipe that is supplying water either into the pond or taking water out of the pond, but there is an artificial condition in addition to whatever natural conditions there were. Is that wrong?
Well, that's what the plaintiffs are trying to argue. I mean, the pipe does permit water to go out one side. The area where the plaintiff fell wasn't anywhere near that pipe. It was over near where the water comes in to the pond. But my position is it doesn't matter, because all the cases dealing with ice establish that ice is a natural condition. It's attendant to bodies of water such as this. And Delaware law, which I would like to read to you, states as follows, and this is a quotation from the Volani case, which is cited in our brief. And the quotation is, bodies of water, especially natural water courses such as the stream in this case is recognized to be, are not subject to the attractive nuisance doctrine. In the absence of some unusual condition or artificial feature other than the mere presence of the water. This rule has been applied also to artificial bodies of water, and there are many cases holding that the doctrine is not applicable to the various kinds of bodies of water which exist today. Now that was more than 50 years ago, and that ruling has never been questioned or changed in this state.
Can you give an example using that statement of the law when there would be liability, because there seemed to be an exception about an artificial condition?
Sure.
What's an example of that?
The hidden trap. One of the cases, or two of the cases actually, that plaintiff relies on are cases. One is a siphon case, and one was there was a hidden hole in the bottom of a body of water, and in each case the deceased child went into that hole that was hidden. It was the hidden trap, and we in Delaware, who are old enough to remember it, remember that when the state dug a bunch of holes in Rehoboth Bay and a whole bunch of people drowned because they were clamming and stepped into these 10-foot holes that had no warning. Those are the hidden trap cases. There's no hidden trap in this case. Ice that is not uniform is not a hidden trap, and the case law is uniform on that, and the plaintiffs have cited no authority to the contrary. We have cited a case, and the trial court cited a case, which is, and unfortunately, the cases I'm relying on are hard to pronounce, but it's entitled Ochambau, and it's an on-bank decision of the Washington Supreme Court, and it makes clear, and it's 100% consistent with the Bolani language, it makes clear that the non-applicability of 339 is to natural bodies of water and artificial bodies having natural characteristics. So the fact that there's water flowing through a pond does not mean it does not have natural characteristics. That is a natural characteristic. Ice freezing or not freezing at a uniform rate is a natural characteristic.
So, as I understand your argument, we never really get to C because based on how you're arguing our prior precedents, 339 just doesn't apply to this because it's not an artificial condition.
Well, that's the ultimate result of what I'm arguing, and the courts have articulated, and that is the position of the vast majority of courts that have considered this question. The plaintiffs at page 29 of the opening brief provided the court with a string citation of cases that they implied were contrary to that vast majority, and we have attempted to provide the court with the facts of those cases in a short way as to why they are distinguishable, and I would be prepared to discuss any of them now, but they are all clearly distinguishable from what is involved in this case. And what is involved in this case is a body of water having natural characteristics. The fact that this pond was used for irrigation purposes in no way changes the applicability of that principle. It has nothing to do with it. I mean, I suppose if a child were sucked into an irrigation pipe, we might have a different issue. But the fact that there were irrigation pipes under this pond has nothing to do with anything in this case, since we're talking about the middle of January anyhow.
So you're suggesting that you know, whatever anomaly or arguable anomaly may exist here, such as the pipe, such as the fact that the pond was used for irrigation purposes, doesn't affect the applicability of Section 339 unless that anomaly is somehow connected to the cause of death or to the danger.
Yes, Your Honor. It has to be connected to the case. And that's why the cases talk about the dangerous conditions and the hidden traps, because they're the things that take a body of water out of the classification of not being an attractive nuisance. And the reason articulated, the primary reason articulated in the cases why the rule is the rule is, and well, let me quote it. The primary reason, as the Ochambau case, and I think most of the other cases state, is that a body of water is an open and recognized hazard. And that's an objective test. When the court was inquiring about whether we should be making a subjective inquiry into this child's mind, I would submit that the courts have uniformly applied an objective test because bodies of water are known to have certain dangers. And they are known to be recognized. And they are not authorizing a case-by-case inquiry into the subjective state of mind of any particular child. It's a recognition that bodies of water have certain positive effects. And I think the language in the Ochambau case, if I can locate it, that they comprise one of our most cherished amenities. And if they didn't comprise cherished amenities for communities, and the communities felt they posed a danger to their children, they can enact laws that require what the plaintiffs say New York Country Club should have done in this case. That is, erect a fence that would render this pond inaccessible, both to children and perhaps to the golfers who Mr. Rhodes said couldn't reach it. I know some golfers that reach this with some regularity.
Can I go back to the question of the artificiality and the impact of that? Let's assume we've got a totally natural pond, and somewhere underwater there's a portion of a tree that had fallen into it, and a real sharp branch is sticking up. So somebody who jumps into that natural pond could wind up seriously injured or killed because they hit this unseen object that's in the bottom of the pond, okay?
Sure.
And that would be no liability, right? It's natural, yeah. And that's the way it goes.
Well, there are circumstances under which you could make an argument
okay.
that there would be liability, but that's a different case.
Okay. But I'm trying to use that as an example because now assume we've got a pond that's an artificially created pond, but it looks the same as a natural pond. And instead of having a branch of a tree underwater that's a potential hazard, it's got some piece of metal that was put there when the pond was created to serve some other purpose, to help with irrigation or for whatever reason. And the person in this case jumps in and lands on that piece of metal and is injured. Would that be the kind of trap that you have acknowledged would allow for potential liability?
It would be the kind of hidden danger that might.
Okay. All right. Fine. And that's what I thought, too. But why is that any different than what we have here? You've got pond A that has some water running through it because that's the kind of pond it is. And nobody realized, or the people who were walking on the ice didn't realize that the ice was going to be different levels of thickness because there's water flowing underneath. So that's a natural pond, too bad. But now we've got this artificial pond that has water flowing that you can't tell. And as a result of that, you have uneven thicknesses of ice. Why doesn't that have potential liability?
Because the case law says that artificial conditions that are like natural conditions do not bring a body of water under 339. And water flowing through ponds is a natural condition, and nobody has suggested to the contrary in this case. And there is certainly no evidence that anything about the flow of water through this pond was somehow so unnatural or dangerous that it created some kind of special hazard. But the law requires before you can be brought under 339, Your Honor.
Mr. Turner, at some risk, I don't want to suggest by my next question to preempt anyone's question here about the artificial condition argument, but let's assume for a moment that you lose on that argument. What's the next issue from your perspective?
Well, the next, there isn't any. If I lose on that issue and...
Well, that might be why you explained your argument was going to be brief.
Well, my argument... in 25 words or less, is that Delaware law treats bodies of water that are either natural or artificial with natural characteristics as not being under 339 in accord with the vast majority of courts in this country, and that there is no need to change that rule, and that if it's going to be changed, it should be changed by the legislature.
But is the other way of saying this an acknowledgement on your part that the Superior Court erroneously granted summary judgment under C as a matter of law?
No, I think C addresses this fact that the bodies of water just do not constitute the kinds of hazards that come within C.
But I think what the Chief Justice was suggesting in his question is if we decide we're going to get into the list, because we don't necessarily agree with your artificial distinction, that's the preamble to getting into the list. The question is, did this 8-year-old appreciate what was going on? And what the Superior Court said in what I characterized as its alternative holding is, as a matter of law, there was no basis under C to let the jury decide any disputed fact.
Well, I would... If I can have a second, Your Honor. I would simply cite the language of the Ochambao case, which I believe addresses C and constitutes a holding that is pretty widely accepted, that the hazards of such natural phenomena may reasonably be expected to be understood and appreciated by any child of an age to be allowed at large. That's in accordance with Delaware law. It's an objective test, and it's not inconsistent with what the trial court did. And I would point out to the court that we've cited a large number of cases that stand for these propositions, that bodies of water with natural characteristics are not an attractive nuisance, that the fact that there's ice to some degree or another on it doesn't change that. The plaintiffs have brought to the attention of the court no case that is directly to the contrary. They've string cited a lot of cases involving water, but every one of them is distinguishable. And I suggest what the plaintiffs are asking the court to do is to depart and to create some law that would have some pretty vast implications, because if you drive around Kent and Sussex County, people are building houses everywhere, and a lot of those houses are being built with ponds, and you're not going to see many of them that are rendered inaccessible by fences. And the only pond that's been come up in this case that is rendered inaccessible is a sewage treatment pond that Sussex County requires be fenced, and I would think the court would understand why you would want to fence in a sewage treatment plant or pond. But once you open the door and get into subjective tests and going through each of the elements of 339, then you're into a case-by-case basis, and the only way landowners can protect themselves is to drain the ponds or build walls around them. And I don't think any legislative body has suggested that that's a desirable thing to do. If there are no more questions, I'm finished.
Thank you.
Members of the court, the Volani decision that was referenced by Mr. Turner is a decision that was in 1954, and it was a decision that predated the cases that we have now that addresses the issue of restatement second section 339. And some of the other concepts that the court has been discussing with Mr. Turner are also concepts that predate the evolution of section 339, because these other concepts of allurement or the concepts of knowledge of the children of the dangers inherent in bodies of water, a lot of those concepts were concepts that grew up around the concept of the attractive nuisance doctrine. Our courts have looked at section 339 sufficiently enough to focus on and to decide this case based on section 339. In fact, I believe that there's a suggestion in the cases that have dealt with 339 that there are to be no hard and fast rules pertaining to the application of section 339 to a particular case. In the Shura versus Carey case, which is a Supreme Court decision, there was a young boy who unfortunately found his way into a power substation. And in that particular situation where the restatement second section 339 was actually adopted, this court showed a flexibility in its use of section 339 that we would hope that the court would find in this particular case. Other decisions that have applied a flexible approach are Bennett versus Holiday Lanes, 1969, Westlaw 99798, Roberts versus Bush, 1987, Westlaw 8661. And that was one of the decisions that was discussed by the Superior Court in this particular case, and the court decided to take a different approach than the judge in the Roberts versus Bush case, now Justice Ridgely. In those decisions, there is a suggestion that Section 339 needs to be applied in a flexible manner, and we would hope that the court would adopt that approach. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.